Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Boris Forkel. He's a radical environmentalist, social rights activist, and subsistence farmer. With the books he publishes with his small press, Babylon Apocalypse, he wants to inspire and encourage dissidents to break through an increasingly narrow public discourse and spread the seeds of decisive resistance and radical social change. So, first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek, for having me.
So let's start with some quotes from the back of your book that are what your book Babylon Apocalypse is about. Why don't I read all three of these questions, and then you can just answer them however you want. Why is it that our Western culture is obviously racing toward the apocalypse? Why is it that this is a well-known scientific fact and yet nobody seems to care? And how can a feeling and thinking person, driven by reason as well as moral and empathy, live during such monstrous times? I think those are three of the most important questions that can be asked. So thank you for asking them, and can you give your best answers?
Yes. Yes, I wrote the essays of this book to try to answer these questions, and I came across this quote by the philosopher Peter Sloterdijk, who's a German philosopher. He said, "We live in a monstrous time for which we have no name yet," and I think that responded with me a lot. But I would actually have a name for this time we live in, and I think you can guess what it is. I would call it apocalypse. So I find it very, very difficult to live in this time we are living in. Because I'm a person who's asking questions, and I can't find sufficient answers to the question. Until now, they haunt me, and so the third question is how do I get along with it? How do I get along living in monstrous times like this? Because I am a feeling and thinking person, and I'm driven by reason, and as well I'm driven by moral and empathy. I'm very empathetic, and it's very hard for me to live so during such monstrous times. And writing is for me, first it was reading, and I'm pretty much influenced by your work, I would say. So I can't say enough praise to your work, Derek. So I started, first publishing books that I found important, and then I started doing some writing myself, because I just had the feeling that I need to express my thinking and my feelings in a way, as kind of first to bring it in public, and second to, as a kind of a therapy for myself, to bring it out, to just bring it out of my mind and out of my soul. And the process of writing helped me to develop a political consciousness, because I was reading a lot, I was thinking about things, I was articulating them in my own way, and it also helped me to remain mentally stable in these monstrous times. So I wish that this book may help others too, keeping mentally stable and maybe finding some answers. Yes, and I think I will continue by reading a little bit of the first essay, if that's okay for you.
Yes,
Derek.
That's great.
Sure. Okay. So the first essay is called "The Mega Machine as a Form of Social Organization." And Yeah, I was thinking about why our culture is in a way so incredibly efficient. It's so incredibly efficient in, well, in destroying everything, the natural world. And at the same time, people care so little. So I go back to the first two of my questions here. And I think this has to do with the kind of social organization that this culture is based on. So, but first in this essay, I go back to my own story. So I started a process of remembering my own childhood. And I remembered it. I will just read now. So on July 10th, 1985, the Rainbow Warrior, ship of the environmental organization Greenpeace, was sunk by agents of the French Service Action. From the 1940s until the 60s, the U.S. Army had been testing atomic bombs on the Marshall Islands. What used to be a South Pacific paradise was now contaminated. The people suffered diseases and cancer. Children were born with abnormalities. In 1985, the residents of the island Rongelap asked Greenpeace for help. The Rainbow Warrior came and relocated 300 people to the island of Mechato. From Mechato, the ship was supposed to move to New Zealand for a short stop and then to the Moruroa Atoll, which is French Polynesia, to protest against French atomic bomb tests. While the Rainbow Warrior was anchored in the port of Auckland, New Zealand, during the night of July 10th, two bombs detonated in the ship's hull. While the ship sunk, most of the crew were able to save themselves, except for the photographer Fernando Pereira, who drowned. Tragically, he was parent of two small children. So I'm going to skip some parts here. In 1985, I was 6 years old. The pictures of the Rainbow Warrior were on the media everywhere. The Greenpeace activists were my heroes. I would look to Greenpeace magazines that shocked me deeply with pictures of baby seals slain with clubs, running rainforests, and dead whales swimming in a sea of blood. So, in my memory, the adults spoke mostly about work. So they said, "How was work?" "Well, okay, I have to work tomorrow. Will you go to work?" "Yes. I hear that you have a new job. How do you like it?" "Yeah, it's pretty okay. Work. I'm at work. I do it for my work, in my work, 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 work." So, and I felt that there was a huge chasm between the conversations I overheard from the adults and the terrifying pictures that stuck in my childish mind from the Greenpeace magazine. They always wanted to know what I want to become when I grow up. The question is hard to understand for a seven-year-old. What should I become? I'm a human being already, and there's not much more that I can actually become. Well, a grown-up human being someday, but such a stressed-out and worried adult who's at the same time dependent on and plagued by his daily work, like the adults around me, I certainly didn't want to become. Why is their work so important to them when at the same time such horrible things are happening? Later, when I understood better what they were up to with that question, I always answered that I wanted to become an environmentalist, like the Greenpeace activist. After I learned to read and write, I printed myself business cards stating environmentalist as profession. Back then, questions evolved that didn't change much over all these years. Why do these people, by all costs, want to kill whales and seals? And why do they want to destroy all these beautiful rainforests everywhere? And why are the people from Greenpeace obviously the only ones who care and try to stop the killing? So, and here I have a short footnote, because I have to say here that back in the days, Greenpeace still consisted mostly of real activists and was pretty radical. The organization has since been corrupted to be part of the non-governmental industrial complex, and as such serves as vital part of industrial capitalism. So Greenpeace is not what it used to be, just as a footnote. So I would ask these questions as a child, but I would stop asking very soon, because I I never received a satisfying answer. The grown-ups would say, "You won't understand this, you are too small." And they would avoid my questions because I didn't like them. They were unpleasant and they had no answers. So as a child, one tends to think that the grown-ups are very smart and know more than children. But unfortunately, this is a fraud. Most adults are very stupid, highly indoctrinated, and don't know any answers to the real important questions. So the questions remain the same, and I guess they will until the very day of my death. Why is our culture killing the planet? Why does nobody care about it? Why are people always talking about work while there's a horrible slaughter going on? When I asked my grandmother why all the Indians had to die, so I remember I had a book, and it was about the genocide in the Americas, and she answered that this had been God's will. The Indians, soon enough, would have built big ships on their own, sailed to Europe, and exterminated us, she said. Well, how great that God is with us. So, thanks to answers like this, I learned to forget my questions and hide my feelings over time, which, after all, arose from a very normal empathy I felt for our fellow beings, and indeed for the whole wonderful, unique planet we all inhabit. So, my 20s were horrible. I went through the mainstream culture with severe depressions. I held myself together with books, which helped me to survive disturbing dreams, to think deeply and question everything. I will always be grateful to these writers. Just to name a few, it's, for example, Erich Fromm, it's you, Derek, it's Black Elk, John Fireland Deer, Ryan Deloria Jr., Jack Forbes, Daniel Quinn, Henry David Thoreau, just to name a few, like people who think out of the box and who ask questions. And I would add that the Native American writers were probably the most important for me because they stand outside of Western culture and they can see our culture as from the outside as the monster that it really is, because we in the West usually we do not see that, and it's very, very hard to see our culture from the outside. Usually I think we cannot do this. And this is a thought I had when I read your work, that that your thinking could never have come from somebody living in Europe. And you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but I thought that that your thinking must be deeply influenced by Native American thinking.
It has been.
Yes, yes. So it was stunning for me because I thought in Europe never nobody would have been able to get outside this Western ideology like you did. Okay, I will continue a little bit. So finally, I found myself realizing that the decision I had made when I was 7 years old to write environmentalist on my business card was still right and valid. Within a culture that mistreats its fellow creatures like ours, resistance is a moral imperative. I understood this as a child. Actually, it isn't very hard to understand. All we have to do is to look around us. Foolishly, we have built a whole culture based on distractions and denial. So now comes the second part of the essay, which try to figure out Lewis Mumford's term, the mega machine. It also has to do with the form of social organization this culture is based on, which might be the most destructive invention that humans have ever made. So now I mention, Would you like to, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I was wondering if you can. I think this is an incredibly important point, and can you go on about this a little bit? And I agree with you completely that you know, people talk about what is the most important or most destructive, whatever term you want to use, invention of this culture, and people talk about, you know, gunpowder, the wheel, the screw, all sorts of various inventions, but I think the most important one, and I'm following Mumford too, is the social organization that he calls the mega machine, where you have humans or non-humans too, who are acting as cogs in a giant social machine. And one of the reasons I think this is incredibly important is because how do you get an army? I mean, you and I both know that if you put five humans in a room, I mean, humans are fundamentally pretty contentious, and we can get along, and even those we really care about, we still disagree with all the time. But when you, it's an extraordinary accomplishment to be able to get a million people working toward the same goal, whether that goal is to make money for the Coca-Cola Corporation, or whether that goal is to invade another country. Or whether that goal is to put dams on every river in the planet. And so can you talk a little bit more about that? I think that that's an incredibly important point.
Yes, sure. So the most destructive invention humans ever made, it's not a technological innovation in a way, but it's a form of social organization. But indeed a very technological form, and therefore it's called a mega machine. As you said, this term is from Lewis Mumford. And a form of social organization that makes it possible for hundreds of thousands of people to spend the majority of their lifetime happily working for the goals of giant corporations like whatever, Daimler-Benz, BASF, Bayer, Deutsche Bank, etc. And hundreds of thousands of employees working strictly organized and brought into line within a hierarchical organization. And not only that, but often there's a very strong identification of the employees with their company. So this is basically the modern version of the social organization that made it possible for the ancient Egyptians, for example, to build the giant symbols of the civilization. In ancient Egypt, the slaves already formed an organized caste. They used strikes as a way to fight for better food, housing, or working conditions. So even back then, many thousand years ago, people had already accepted their fate as a working class or as a slave class as part of the giant machine, and they tried to ensure or to negotiate slightly better conditions within it. Yes, and it also, slavery and agriculture, they are both the cradle of civilization. Because large-scale monoculture is only possible with slaves initially. Initially, slaves must be held in captivity and forced to work. But over a few thousand years, our culture perfected the machine more and more. So with a permanent combination of organized violence, lies, propaganda, and powerful institutions like state, church, and school, the original forms of social organization were destroyed and replaced with a breed of totally isolated human beings who identify themselves as workers and do not resist anymore. These are the happy slaves that serve the machine. Without them, factories are unthinkable. There would be no industrial agriculture, no machines, no industrial production. Yeah, and yes, please, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to, I think that what you just said is really powerful, and I just wanted to sort of reflect on that or emphasize that for a moment before we go on. But I think that's just really crucial. That's all. I didn't have a substantive comment. It's just I think what you said is very important.
Yeah, well, thank you. So I think it has been a quite a long process, since the first civilizations were based on slavery, basically violence. But nowadays, it's not. There's no or very little direct violence anymore. So they have perfected the machine over time. And part of that is religion, institutionalized religion, like Christianity, plays a very, very important role, because it has teaching us, has been teaching us for thousands of years, that life is a veil of tears and it's full of privation, and that the reward for all the privation will come after death if we behave obedient and so during our lifetime. And also there's the work ethic as a new religious doctrine, which is the basis of for capitalist ideology. Yes, and I think that the modern industrial capitalism is the most extreme and by far the most destructive form, because it combines this form of social organization with actual machines. So nowadays we have cars, we have computers, and the humans who are functioning as part of these mega machines, they are themselves handling machines all the time. So they identify more with their car, for example, or with their computer, or their watch, or their smartphone, or the company they work for, then they would identify with other living beings, including other humans. So what's so stunning for me when I read about the ongoing extinction of insects, like 80% decline, I feel horrible. I feel like panicking. But I see that the general population is not panicking. And also the decline in songbirds, they are not panicking. It's like it doesn't concern most of people. And I really have a hard time understanding that. But at the same time, if you have, for example, driving restrictions because there's increasing air pollution, they will demonstrate right away, because they love their cars and they can't imagine living without them. But they can imagine living without songbirds. But I think they are not even thinking about it. They just don't care. Yes. So the problem is they are loyal to the machines and they're not loyal to living beings. So I came to the conclusion that neither the machine nor its parts are intelligent or in any way moral, because it's not intelligent to poison the air that we need to breathe, and it's not intelligent to poison the water that we need to drink, and the soil that grows our food, or even the food itself with pesticides and herbicides, which are actually weapons of war. And I'm asking, where's the movement for peace? So people who strike or who fight for better working conditions or against cutbacks of jobs, they are already perfectly oiled gears of the machine, because they have been born and raised as its part, and their perception has very restricted limits already. So they do not know any real freedom. As a part of a machine, when a human being is a part of a machine, functioning as a part of a machine, they don't have to think but to function. So, and the gainful employment, the profession, is a very important part of individual identity in the modern society. And if humans exist as parts of a machine, they forget how to be responsible for their own lives and the lives of their children. and for all of life on the planet. They forget that they should be responsible. They should feel responsible. So this is one explanation why so few people are resisting against the destruction of the planet, because the liability, the responsibility for the machine is never carried by its parts. It's a very strict hierarchical system, and the responsibility is always somewhere on top of the hierarchy. Also, a machine has no empathy. So applied organized violence is part of its function.
I don't remember if this was Mumford made this point, or if Robert J. Lifton made this point, or if some other person writing about the Holocaust made this point, but one of the brilliant things about the whole mega machine is that once it's in place, it doesn't really matter if the trains are carrying wood to be taken to a sawmill, or whether the train is carrying automobiles to be delivered, or whether it's coal to be burned, or whether it's Jews to be taken to a death camp, that once you have the machine in place, it just functions. And I believe it was Raoul Wallenberg. I could have this totally wrong, but it was one of the famous historians of the Holocaust talked about how most of the participants in the Holocaust did not shoot Jews face to face or gas them. Most of them answered memos, answered telephones, typed up memos, attended meetings, did absolutely no different than any other person on any other corporate staff, or any other bureaucratic staff, I should say.
Yes. It's needless to say that the Third Reich was functioning perfectly according to the principles of this mega machine. So, I think it was Hannah Arendt. She reported about this famous process against Adolf Eichmann, and she said he was just a bureaucrat. So I think maybe that's what you're up to.
There's another thing I want to mention. You were talking earlier about people identifying more with their car, their computer, their smartphones. And I've seen some advertisements on television lately here in the United States that are taking for granted that people are addicted to their technologies. There's one that has a song in the background, Never Gonna Let You Go, as a guy is holding on to his cell phone under all circumstances, and then he gets in the car and drives, and he puts the cell phone away and gives it to his partner. But the thing that is blowing me away with these is they are taking for granted that this addiction. And then I put that together with an essay I was just reading a couple days ago, where some guy was talking about how he was doing talks on campuses and walking across campus, like 90% of the students were either looking at or talking on their cell phones at any time. And then there's one more thing I wanted to add to this, but I think I'm forgetting it. I can't remember right now. It's just this level of identification with the machine is, and I guess what I'm saying is these advertisements are acknowledging this level of, there was one more thing I was going to say to bring this all home, and I'm sorry, I can't remember. So anyway, say whatever you'd like about that.
Yes. Yeah, of course. The advertisement is taking on that, and yeah, I think that humans, they are in desperate need of to identify with something, and nowadays that our cultures basically has been destroyed. So we are live in a state of this individualism, and we do not have any real culture left in the Western world, at least.
Oh, I know
So
what I was
people
going to
are
say.
very desperate. Oh, okay.
And sorry to interrupt, but I think you can take this somewhere too. The other thing I was going to say is I was reading this thing the other day that said that I don't remember the percentage, but it was like 40%, some huge percent. It wasn't 1% or anything. It was some huge percent of people check their cell phones during sex. I don't know. I don't. I. That shows a profound level of identification. You're identifying with that machine more than you're identifying with this person that you're being intimate with.
Yes, this is amazing. Yeah, screen culture, as we know, is incredibly addictive, and smartphones are like the perfect little screen that everybody can carry anywhere, and you can do basically everything with them. You can do online shopping, you can do chat. I'm talking to you with my smartphone via Skype. So you can talk to people all over the world. And yeah, we are all screen addicts in a way, sure. But yes, this level is astonishing.
So we can either go whatever direction you want, or we can go back to having sort of introduced yourself more. What answers have you come up with for why it is that this culture is racing toward the apocalypse? And I mean, let's go back to those questions, because I think those are the three most important questions there are to ask. Well, the
Yes,
fourth
yes.
important question is, how do we stop it?
Sure. Yes. So, how do we stop it? So, okay, let me get to the third question. How can a feeling, a thinking person driven by reason as well as moral and empathy live during such monstrous times? And also, how do we stop it? And I think the first step that we have to take, and I went through this process myself with help of your work, is that we stop identifying with this culture and that we start a process of identifying with the natural world and the living beings that surround us. This is, I think, the first step we have to take. And most people don't do that because nature is basically in our culture not of any worth. Maybe some beautiful flowers, but or for recreation, whatever. But people usually, and this culture doesn't care about nature. And actually, it was when I read your work, you were always talking about salmon, for example. And I thought, okay, this is kind of strange because I know salmon from the supermarket. It's food. It's pretty expensive food that I can buy, and it's shipped here from Norway usually. So I had no relation to salmon in any way. But I was curious, and then I live near a very beautiful river, the Neckar, and also the Rhine. So I was asking myself, okay, let's do some research. And I found out that like about 150 years ago, there used to be salmon here. And it was even a very important source for fishery. And I also learned that when the industrialization process went on and the rivers were dammed more and more, there were people, fishermen were resisting because they saw that their livelihoods would have been destroyed. So I learned that the process that you are oftentimes describing about the U.S., that this process has been going on here for a longer time, and you have still something left in the U.S. We have very little left, and with ever little nature left, of course, there's not much more to identify with, not much left to identify with. So it's getting harder and harder. But anyway, it's incredibly important. And my next essay is about this, because what I was describing in this essay helped me a lot to come to my senses again in terms of identifying with the real beings, the real important beings and the nature. So I write about how I spent an evening sitting in my garden, and I'm talking to a toad. I was really depressed and desperate, but I love the springtime, and I go out to my garden. I do that each year, and I spend a lot of time there in the evenings, and I'm waiting for the toads, because they will come each year, and they will have their mating rituals there, and I just love to hear them. So there was a toad sitting next to me, and I just talked to her. Yeah, the essay is called "Call Me Crazy: Babylon Apocalypse." So, because if I talk about this, I am talking to a toad. Usually, people would say I'm crazy, of course. But it was a wonderful process, because I felt that she had something to say. So I told her about deep green resistance, about the destruction of the natural world by our culture, and I asked her to tell me how she and her kind perceive all of this. And I don't know if I understood her correctly, but what I heard was, well, too many of us are dying. We know that some of you are trying to help us. That's not enough. It has to stop. So, and actually it doesn't matter if I'm projecting or not, because the toad is right. Yes, and then I described that I regularly go to the wildest places that still exist here and listen to nature. So I see different kinds of insects. I see wild bees, bumblebees, mosquitoes, beetles, a few dragonflies. I see or hear birds. And I hear the call of the codger when it gets dark, and I also welcome the stag beetles. There's a picture on the cover of the book of a stag beetle, and I'm happy to live near an area where they are still quite numerous. So they will come out of the ground at the beginning of June, and they have lived in the ground for 3 years as increasingly fattening grubs, and at the beginning of June, they will fly with a huge hum into the summer forest, where they live exclusively from the sap of rare old oak trees, which their females prepare for them, since the males cannot bite the bark because of their huge antlers. So that's one of my rituals I do. So waiting for the toads and waiting for the stag beetles every June to welcome them. And also, I'm trying to connect to other beings, and to see whatever squirrels, bats, grass frogs, spotted salamanders. So, and I continue to this essay with I'm thinking about the European bison, because I just love them. And also, I also did research about them. They have been exterminated like 300 years ago. So that's basically cousin of the American bison. They are very similar. They used to inhabit this area with in large numbers. Nowadays, they are very, very few. Maybe in Poland, they live in the wild, very few. And I used to visit them in a zoo. And even the ones that are forced to live in captivity are gigantic. They are beautiful, trusting, and kind. And they look at me with loving eyes, each of them asking the same question. Why? Yes. So...
You know, that reminds me of Judith Herman in her book Trauma and Recovery says that ultimately that's the question that every survivor of trauma comes to is why, you know, whether you're a survivor of childhood abuse or of a survivor of rape by someone who crawled in through your window or a survivor of the Holocaust or survivor of the current ongoing ecological Holocaust. That's the question everybody comes to, is why? To which Judith Herman posits there ultimately is no sufficient answer.
Yes, right. Yeah. I felt that when I was watching these European bisons, I felt that they were coming to me and they were looking at me with large, intelligent eyes. And I felt that they are asking me, why? Why are you doing that? Why are you humans doing this to us? And in fact, they are survivors of the Holocaust, as basically all animals, all wild animals.
So we're having about 5 minutes left. So do you want to continue a little bit more with this, with talking about what you write in that essay, or what do you want to do?
Yes, I would just read the last paragraph, I think. So. The natural world is full of wisdom. So often I've sat here or there, listening, speaking, praying. The river, the forest, and all the creatures who still live here speak different languages and have different messages. They taught me a lot, and I have a lot more to learn. But in one thing they all agree. It has to stop. Babylon apocalypse.
So, hearing... What do you want for people hearing this to do? It's sounding to me, I'm going to put some words in your mouth, you can tell me if they're wrong. It sounds to me like you're wanting people, for a first step at least, to go outside, and then for a second step to stop this madness. Is that reasonably accurate?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I want them to identify with which is with what is really important, which is the natural world, which keeps us all alive, and which is basically we are all in the same boat. We have to understand this. So I want them to identify with the natural world and wild beings, and to see them as their relatives. And I want them to become their allies and to help them in any way they can to survive. And this includes stopping the destruction. Yes, sure.
So I want to end on a really mundane note. How do people tell people more about your publishing and about how they can get a hold of this book and the other books you publish?
So, okay. I have my own small kind of press, which is BabylonApocalypse.org, where you can find all the books I published so far and ways to order them. You can also just search for my name on any kind of online bookstore, Amazon or whatever you like. You can also write down the ISBN number when you visit my website and you are interested in one particular book. You can write down the ISBN number if you want to avoid Amazon, and you can go to any bookstore basically in the Western world, and they should be able to order this book with this international book serial number. Yes, and people can also check out, of course, Deep Green Resistance. So deepgreenresistance.org is our international radical environmental organization.
Well, is there anything else you want to add to any of this?
Yes. If you listen to this, and if you're maybe confused, which is understandable, I would encourage you to read a lot, and basically not to sit on your butt, but to do something, to find what you like, what you love, and to defend it. And yes, I wish you good luck with that.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Boris Forkel. This is Derek Gentin for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.